This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 110 was recorded on March 22, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Alhambra Investments CIO Jeff Snyder returns as this week's feature interview guest, and of course our regular listeners know Jeff is one of our most popular guests. The topic this week is going to be the Treasury yield curve, and those of you who know Jeff's style won't be surprised to learn that there's a very substantial book of charts and graphs to support this week's interview. You'll find the download link in your research roundup email, or if you're not registered yet, you'll find registration and download instructions next to Jeff's picture on our homepage at macrovoices.com. This interview was pre-recorded several weeks ago, so please don't be surprised that some of the graphs and charts are not completely up to date. I think you're really going to enjoy today's show. Jeff gave us a fantastic interview, but I want to warn you that it's going to be an extra long show this week. But hey, what are we going to do? Cut Jeff Snyder short? We'd face a listener rebellion if we did that. And what's more, with all of the action in equity markets in the last few days, particularly today, Thursday afternoon, Patrick has pulled together a fantastic post-game chart book that takes our equity analysis to a global scale. So dig in, get that second beer ready, and stand by for a long one, but a good one this week.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 really looks like it's going for that double bottom retest of the February lows, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. And it's so frustrating. You know, I knew this was coming. I was very confident that it was going to happen when we saw what to me was the logical place to short it, which is we hit 2760 and the top of the downsloping channel, that channel resistance line. I shorted it and I ended up getting stopped out as it continued to march higher. And sure enough, we hit, 2801, 2802. I was tempted to short that round number resistance. I should have. And of course, now we're more than 100 points lower. I think at this point, I suspect it probably is headed below 2,500, but we've moved so far, you know, it's too late to short it as far as I'm concerned. You never know where it's going to bounce. I think you and I have both been expecting there's a retest of the lows, but is that a higher low or a lower low? We're not really sure. So I think from my perspective, it's probably too late to short this move, but I suspect it's going lower. What might be worth looking at is where that low might be in terms of playing the upside of it, but I think it's too late for the short trade. In any case, let's take this conversation to our post-game segment because I want to take it global and look not only at U.S. indices, but also at what's going on around the world.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, which reacted negatively to the initial response of the Fed, but since then has stabilized. Where do you think the dollar's going here?
It's interesting. Certainly, as I've said before, I think this is the most important thing to watch right now. Figuring out what the dollar is going to do is probably the most important issue in macro. I'm surprised by the number of people this week that have been saying, okay, that's it. Dollar's toast. Top is in. We're headed straight down. That's it. As I look at the chart, Patrick, I don't see that, you know, the end is nigh. It appears to me that this could resolve either way. I think there's good arguments on either side. So I'm still cautiously undecided. I definitely think this is the thing to watch, and I'm looking for decisive action. But as far as I'm concerned, we haven't seen it yet.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because that triangle formation that's been developing over the last month or more has seemed to like it's broken to the upside. What's your thinking here?
Well, as our long-term listeners know, my expectation was that triangle on the daily pattern was going to break to the downside, and I thought that would take us down towards a price target of between $50 and $55. What we've seen is, of course, a bullish resolution, which is not at all what I expected, breaking out last Friday on the upside of that. But you know, Patrick, something's fishy here to me because the move started Friday with no apparent news. Now, certainly you could say this week that the inventory data was bullish and that certainly helped the rally, but we didn't know that on Friday. I don't think that the Europe sanctioning Iran was big enough. And frankly, that news came out quite a bit after the move in crude oil happened. So it almost felt like somebody knew something that wasn't public suddenly on Friday morning, and that maybe that was responsible for it. A lot of the traders on Twitter were just saying, hey, it's just Friday in the crude oil market. Algos run the prices higher on thin volume. You know, I've seen that before, and it felt different to me. We got pushed way up to a high number right at the top of that triangle formation. Usually, if it's just algo-driven light volume stuff, you see a retracement from a move like that, and there really wasn't any retracement. And then, of course, Tuesday and Wednesday, massive moves up in price, but really not a whole lot of volume participation. Now, Wednesday, inventory definitely helped, but you know, it wasn't until late on Tuesday afternoon, 4:30 Tuesday, is when API, the private inventory service, reports their inventory. And then EIA, of course, is on Wednesday morning. We had most of this move happen before we even got to API. So something was driving it. Somebody knew something starting on Friday. And it took it very decisively through what I would have expected to be very strong resistance at the upper trend line on that triangle. So I really was surprised by this move. Time spread behavior has also been really, really weird this week. The spreads blew out much wider as the price of oil went up into Wednesday's close. No surprise there. But then after the close on Wednesday, as prices of crude oil continued to move about 50 cents higher, those spreads almost retraced their entire move of the day by 5 p.m. It was really weird. So it seems like, are the spreads maybe fading the move higher because the spreads are smarter and they knew the market's about to reverse? Well, then Wednesday night into Thursday, overnight, the front month sells off and the spreads end up widening back to where they were as of the close on Wednesday afternoon. So the moves are opposite one another. It doesn't make any sense to me. So Patrick, it makes me wonder what's going on here. What's driving this? Because I really don't see the fundamental driver, and frankly, I wasn't expecting it. Now, maybe I'm just wrong about where this market was headed. It certainly would be true if this turned out to be a false breakout to the upside and we ended up moving below $61, which would be a bearish resolution after all to that triangle pattern. That would be extremely bearish to see a big upside move then get reversed and resolve downside. That's an extreme long shot, but if it does happen, it would be super bearish. As far as inventory this week, Wednesday morning, EIA reported a drawdown of 2.6 million barrels nationally. That was on expectations of about a 3 million barrel build. That really helped the rally to continue dramatically on Wednesday, late morning and into afternoon. But again, most of this big move up from $61 or so happened before inventory came out. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 905,000 barrels. Really important to see that finally we're getting builds in Cushing, Oklahoma, a couple of weeks in a row. Cushing is, of course, very, very important because it's where that heavy blend stock comes from. As Pat Hemsworth told us about the shortage of heavy blending stock for refineries to mix with the lighter shale oil, Cushing is where it's stored, and they were really drawing down dramatically, a couple million barrels a week. Now we're seeing builds, and those builds are getting bigger week over week. So that's a really good sign for Cushing. Gasoline drawing down 1.7 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 2 million barrels. Production up another 26,000 barrels this week to another record, 10.407 million barrels per day. I believe that is an all-time record for U.S. production. Exports also up to 1.6 million barrels. That's 11 million barrels on a weekly equivalent basis. That's pretty darn considerable. If you take that 2.6 million barrel drawdown, it would be about a 9 million barrel build if exports were still illegal. Except for the production data, though, this was clearly bullish and it helped the rally that was underway. Now, today's pullback on Thursday, as we're speaking just after 4 o'clock, we're looking at 64 spot 28 on West Texas Intermediate crude oil for May delivery. And that represents a pretty significant pullback of more than a dollar from where we closed at the end of the day yesterday. But, you know, frankly, even if this is a healthy bull market and we are headed, that triangle, by the way, would have a price target on the upside breakout at about 67 spot 76. If we're headed up there, today's pullback would be perfectly natural after two really big up days. And we may see Friday is very often an up day in crude oil markets. Now, if the stock market continues to crash, all bets are off. But there's a good chance that this rally resumes tomorrow on Friday. The big caveat from my perspective, though, is I don't understand what's driving it. Clearly, the breakout above the triangle is motivating a lot of people to have a bullish view. But, you know, if you look at volume participation, the price is moving more than volume. It just makes me feel, especially with Mohammed bin Salman in town talking to Donald Trump this week, does somebody know something we don't know about what they're talking about? Maybe some kind of deal having to do with Iran and the U.S. getting more aggressive with Iran in exchange for some kind of concession from Saudi Arabia. Somebody knows something we don't. I don't know. I'm completely guessing here. But it feels to me like there's more driving this market to the upside than the news obviously reveals.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, but I guess there's not too much to say because gold really just continues to move to the reciprocal of the dollar. We haven't seen that trend change. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, I agree with that completely. It's all about the dollar. And, you know, key support here, about 1308. Quite a few technicians I follow say that's the number. So far, it's holding, and it's been tested a few times, and it's held each time. So, you know, if for the bulls, it would say that 1308, that was your buying opportunity. If we get it again, that's where you want to buy. The thing is, jury's still out for me until this dollar trend is clearer. And for me, it's not.
Eric, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, because after Powell's press conference, we saw a temporary spike up towards those 295 levels, but we find that that all completely reversed and we're at a month low near about 282. What's your thinking here on yields?
Well, you know, as you say, we're back down. Everybody freaked out on the Fed. And what was it? Two spot 95, two spot 96 up there somewhere was the top of that spike. And sure enough, it's all retraced and even lower. I still have the view that we discussed last week, which is I think that there's a very good chance that Jeff Gundlach is right about the secular trend toward higher yields. But boy, if there's ever been a setup for a short squeeze, we're looking at it here with the massive everybody on one side of the boat short on dollar index futures. So I think that there's a very good chance of a short squeeze that takes us to, let's say, below 2.60 on the 10-year yield. And I think that potentially is your opportunity to short treasuries, or more likely for me, I would be inclined to short high yield at that point, because I think since high yield is mostly priced as a spread above treasury yields, the price of those high yield bonds is going to go up as treasury bonds go up, as yields come down. So I think the short squeeze scenario is going to create a short selling opportunity in whatever your favorite fixed income instrument is, but that's still a ways off. In the meantime, as we go into this interview with Jeff Snyder, this was recorded several weeks ago, but I just want to emphasize the very, very tight spreads, minimum kinds of numbers, very, very flat spreads that Jeff discusses in this interview. Almost 2 months later, since that was taped, we're still looking at the same situation. So although the charts and graphs may not be completely up to date in this pre-recorded interview, I think you'll find the commentary is very much on par with current market events.
Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. This week's featured interview guest is Alhambra Investment CIO Jeffrey Snyder. Eric's interview with Jeffrey Snyder is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Alhambra Investment CIO Jeffrey Snyder. The subject today is, of course, going to be yield curves. Jeff, you know, I think most people know that there's this statistic that every major post-war recession has been predicted by an inverted yield curve. And the thing that strikes me is, first of all, I think there's probably more information to gain from just whether or not the curve is inverted. But particularly, this statistic about all these post-war recessions, all of those recessions happened before the current era of central bank intervention in the treasury market. And it also was before the breakdown in the Eurodollar system, which you described in Eurodollar University as not really occurring until 2007. So Why don't we start with the big picture? What should we be thinking about when we think yield curve? What does it tell us? Is it just the inverted or not, or is there more to it? And how has the picture changed since 2007, 2008, when so many things about the structure of the market are different now?
Well, first, Eric, you're exactly right. The yield curve tells us a lot more than just when it's inverted and when we should expect recession. There's a whole lot of dynamic information embedded within the curves and various parts of the curves that we can look at that tell us a lot about where we are and where we're going. And it's more than just recession or not. We can look at an even bigger picture than that. What is the baseline economic growth, or what is the bond market telling us about not just the baseline economic condition, but how that relates to monetary policy? In some ways, the yield curve is almost like a check on monetary policy, because the short end relates to what the Fed is doing and monetary alternatives that the Fed can create through its various programs, while the long end says, well, are those programs effective? And so the combination of the short end and the long end in real time gives us a lot of dynamic and very useful information, far more than whether it inverts in recession. There's a lot there that we need to pay attention to, and a lot there that people should have been paying attention to for a very long time.
Jeff, let's go ahead and get into your excellent slide deck. As I look at slide 4, which is where your first chart is, of course, for anyone who's not familiar, when we talk about a yield curve, we're talking about the comparison of a shorter duration treasury yield to a longer duration treasury yield. Here, you're actually displaying two different curves, the 2s-10s curve, the difference between the 2-year treasury and the 10-year treasury in dark blue, and the 5s-10s curve, which is the difference between the 5- and 10-year treasury yield in the lighter blue color. It certainly seems as though in this era that we now have of targeting interest rates, that the action towards the right end of the chart is showing us steeper curves. Is that because of central bank policy?
Absolutely. That is definitely the hallmark of interest rate targeting, the introduction of interest rate targeting, especially under the Greenspan regime. And all it really says is that the Fed, in an attempt to try to smooth out the business cycle, they have been far more hyperactive at the short end, you know, the federal funds target, which they used as their policy lever, than they had been at any point in the past. And that's simply because monetary policy before the 1970s was not set by an interest rate target. The Fed went through a couple different regimes in the 70s, which obviously we know is the Great Inflation. And therefore, we can say that they experimented in a lot of different failures. But from the 1980s forward, they thought they had settled on a positive regime where they could influence the yield curve and therefore influence the economy through their monetary policy techniques. And what it had, the practical effect of that was for the yield curve, it ended up steepening the yield curve in these situations clustered around recessions. And obviously that makes sense in a technical way, because when the Fed reduced its federal funds rate, that had the effect of lowering or reducing monetary alternatives, and therefore short-term treasury yields and other monetary equivalents would fall in yield in sympathy. However, the issue, again, is not just short-term rates, but what does that mean in the long term? And so that's, I think, what we really need to discuss as the yield curve steepens. What does that actually mean?
Okay, Jeff, why don't we touch on that question then of what does a steepening yield curve mean? Because I think the simple understanding that a lot of people have been told is, well, you know, a flattening yield curve is an indication of a weakening economy. A steepening yield curve is an indication of an improving economy, because better, higher, longer dated rates means that people are optimistic about the economic future and the market is essentially anticipating longer term that there's going to be economic growth and so forth. Is that the right way to interpret the yield curve, or is there other meaning that people should be interpreting the signal that the yield curve is giving them with?
Well, that's certainly the general impression that you get from a steeper yield curve is a very positive sign. And that's actually what monetary policy is looking for. In driving down short-term rates via the federal funds interest rate target, the idea from the Fed's perspective is exactly that, to make it look like things are going to be better in the future. They can point to a steeper yield curve and tell the public and the investing public and say, look, the bond market thinks that things are going to be better down the road. Don't worry about what's bad today. It's all going to be good tomorrow. Now, the question is that a really steeper yield curve, or is there artificial elements to it? And if there are artificial elements to it, what does that mean? And we can flip that question around. And, you know, if you look at slide 5, which is when the yield curve inverts, what does it actually mean when the yield curve inverts? Is there artificiality there too? You know, what are we really looking at in this regime of interest rate targeting where the yield curve has become steeper overall in these various periods? What is the Fed's role in steepening and flattening the yield curve? And what does that actually tell us?
Well, let's go ahead and answer that question, Jeff. What does it tell us? Because on the one hand, I could see an argument that says if the Fed is suppressing those short-term rates, it really is providing an immediate stimulus to the economy by making money cheap. So maybe it really does stimulate the economy. On the other hand, frankly, a lot of what you just said to me sounded like a con job. The way that the Fed tricks people into thinking that things are better than they really are is by suppressing the short end of the curve in order to create this steepening shape, which everybody historically associates back from the days of when free markets determined all these things, with an improving economy. So which is it? Is it an indication of manipulation that is concealing the truth? Or is there really truth there? Because after all, when the Fed makes money cheap in the short run, that has a stimulative effect.
What we're really trying to get at here is, what is the yield curve telling us about that very fact? Is what we're seeing at the short end, what the Fed does in trying to influence short-term rates, what does that mean? What does that do to the market? What does that do to the economy? And that's where the long end comes in. Again, as I said earlier, it's a check on those assumptions. We all, you know, in the 90s and the 2000s, we were led to believe that the Fed knew what it was doing. Not only that it knew what it's doing, that it had immense power to do these kinds of things through these various programs and through these various targets to achieve these goals. But if we actually step back and look at the yield curve during these periods, and I want to go into the last rate hike cycle in the middle 2000s, because I think that's instructive in telling us, you know, how we should view the yield curve under this kind of influence and this kind of a regime. So if you go to slide 6, what you see is the entire cycle, starting with the Fed reducing rates in 2000 and 2001, and then completing that with rate hikes through 2004 and 2006. What stands out to me on that chart isn't the V-shape of short-term rates, it's the relative stability of the 10-year. In other words, through that whole period, the long bond, remember there was no 30-year throughout most of that period, the long end of the yield curve didn't really move. No matter what the Fed did, no matter what the 2-year did, which was again steepening of the yield curve at that point, the 10-year was really pretty stable the entire time. Which importantly tells us that the long end of the yield curve, or the long end of the bond market, where economic alternatives are supposed to be, and where that all plays out in very deep and dramatic and liquid fashion, the long end of the curve wasn't convinced that things were fixed. Again, because you know the nominal 10-year stayed in a pretty very narrow range the entire time up and down.
Moving on to slide 7, we're getting into rate hikes. So give us an understanding of why the central bank undertakes these rate hiking programs that always seem to, it always has felt to me like one day they announce, okay, we're going to have a 25 basis point rate hike every meeting until the economy blows up, and we're not sure how long that's going to take. And when it does, then we'll deal with it at that point. I guess there must be more to it than that. That's just the way it seemed to me. How does this work?
Well, in theory, it's pretty simple, right? I mean, the Fed believes that things are getting better, therefore they have to get ahead of it, because if things get better too much, it produces inflation and all sorts of nasty consequences. I mean, that's the dominant orthodox economic theory, that we can't have things be too good. Therefore, we have to put the brakes on. And so between June 2004 and June 2006, in a 2-year period, the Fed raised rates 17 times. They brought the federal funds target up, which was then an unbelievably low level of 1%, all the way to 5.25% over 2 years. And in that time, because they thought things were getting better economically, and I mean in really fundamental terms, the economy was turned around. It had shaken off not just the dot-com recession, which was pretty mild, but more importantly, the lack of recovery following it, which was what really concerned the Fed in the first place. I mean, the last rate cuts in that cycle regime were done well after the dot-com recession had ended, because they realized, and I think a lot of people realized, that the recovery was for some reason, it wasn't igniting the way that it had in the past. There was no V-shape to it. And so they wanted to make sure, keeping the low 1% of federal funds target all the way to 2004, the Greenspan's Fed wanted to be sure that the economy was really on a recovery footing before they started to get back to normal. That's what they were aiming at there. In 2004, 2005, and 2006, they really thought that they were going to bring everything back to what they thought was normal. The federal funds rate before they had started in 2000, the rate cuts in 2000, had been as high as 6.5%. And that's where they were trying to get back to. They wanted to get everything back to normal because they thought the economy was going back to the same way it was in the late 90s. What they found out was that pretty quickly on in their rate hike regime, again, the long-term rates, the long-term treasury rates were not reflecting the same thing that Alan Greenspan thought was taking place. If he was right about everything, if we're going back to solid growth back like that in the 90s, the 10-year treasury should have been rising in concert with short-term rates. The yield curve would compress a little bit, but not as much as it was because the long end wasn't moving at all. And so by February, early 2005, you know, Alan Greenspan testified to Congress that they had run into this conundrum, as he called it. He couldn't explain why the long end of the Treasury curve wasn't moving the way he thought it would move. And he wasn't alone in that. In fact, that was the consensus view. Bill Gross, who has made a name for himself, especially in the last 10 years, calling an end to the 30-year bull market in Treasury bonds, which, by the way, I hate that term. There's no such thing as a bull market in Treasury bonds. But anyway, you know, Bill Gross back in 2005 was just as confused as Alan Greenspan was about the long rate. And he actually said it in his PIMCO investment outlook that he has been befuddled by it. And what it was really telling us was that the market did not see the economy the same way that Alan Greenspan did. Alan was going to raise the interest rates no matter what, because he was sure that the economy was on its way to better days. And the long-term Treasury market reflected in the 10-year was saying, wait a minute, things aren't really that good. And not only that, there are an inordinate number of risks out there that I don't think the Federal Reserve is paying attention to. Of course, then at the time, being the housing mania, but not just the housing bubble, but also the Eurodollar bubble as a whole. And so that had the effect of the Federal Reserve pushing short-term rates back up, just as they drew them down in 2000 and 2001, all the way to 2003. They were now pushing short rates back up against an obstinate long-term rate. And that had the effect of course, very much flattening the yield curve to the point where toward the end of the cycle, you know, 2006, early first half of 2006, they all pretty much equalized. It was all big, one big mass where the short-term rates, the federal funds target, and long-term bond rates were all basically the same thing. And they stayed that way for several months before the long bond then said, you know what, we don't buy it at all. And that's when the yield curve inverted in 2006. The idea being, again, that, you know, the market doesn't necessarily have to reflect exactly what the Federal Reserve is trying to tell us. Because, you know, the Federal Reserve doesn't have a monopoly. They don't have a crystal ball about the future. And in fact, as we've observed over the last 15 years, they're more often wrong than right. And so I think that the long-term bond skepticism about short-term rates and what the Fed is trying to do with them is a healthy one. And that's a main lesson I think that we need to take out of that last rate hike cycle and this difference between long rates and short rates is the idea that, you know, there doesn't have to be harmony there. The Fed can get it wrong.
Jeff, as you were talking, something that really occurred to me is in the same time frame that you're talking about, early 2000s, the other big trend that was going on is a lot of mortgage debt, particularly subprime junk quality mortgage debt that was secured by dubious collateral, was being securitized, in a lot of cases sold to people who didn't understand what they were buying. So there was a tremendous demand and a tremendous tolerance for buying what were really low quality bonds. Is there a contagion effect? Now, that was in housing, not in treasury rates. But of course, housing is such a big part of the debt market. Was there a contagion that maybe this demand for low quality housing because of the rating abuses that were going on and so forth, low quality mortgage backed securities could have somehow had a contagion to help suppress the long end of the treasury curve?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt that there was related effects and in direct spillovers even. I mean, back at that point, the idea was any risk was good risk. It didn't matter what it was. You could buy the most toxic of toxic waste, which is what they called it back then, or they called it after the fact. But I mean, at the time, many people knew that some of the securitizations, especially the CDO squareds and not just subprime, but even prime stuff, was just absolutely the worst junk out there. And even though people were buying that and there were ready buyers for all that stuff, there were a lot of smart people who said that this is risky stuff. And therefore, they were willing to hedge, and they actually did hedge using the treasury market. And so that's embedded in the long-term treasury rate, too, not just economic risk, but financial risk of all of the stuff blowing up. And that was a portfolio effect that I don't believe the Federal Reserve really very well understood, because in a lot of ways, it didn't want to. You know, you go back to the idea of interest rate targeting to begin with, the impetus for it in a lot of ways is that economic growth covers up all ills. You can go back to World War II, the U.S. racked up a massive amount of debt trying to win the war in World War II. And rather than have to face default afterward, everybody said, you know, the way we get out of this is we grow our way out of it. We inflate our way out of it, essentially. And so that idea has taken hold in smaller ways, including in what we see here. You know, the Fed was very much trying to believe in the idea that it could just create growth from nothing by its manipulation of interest rates in the short term part of the yield curve. In the long term end, so the 10-year and out, because the 30-year had been introduced by that point, what they were saying is, no, I mean, you can't just do these things willy-nilly. There are consequences to everything that's happened, and that we're going to have to pay attention to those consequences because we're the ones on the hook for it.
Now, as we're looking here at slide 7, I see this goes up through 2006, so up to the financial crisis. As we move on to slide number 8, it looks like we're looking at a much more recent series. So what is the relationship here to the last slide?
Yeah, and this is what I think the major point that people need to pay attention to today. The major point about using what happened in the last rate hike cycle as maybe a template for expectations about this current one. And it starts with the idea that the process here, you know, the Fed is trying to push short-term rates up with the idea that it would push the whole yield curve up, therefore reflecting what the Fed wants everybody to believe, which is inflation and growth. And so that's just the part that's similar. If you look at between slide 8 and slide 7, you see the same kind of thing happening. The Fed is pushing short-term rates up, but the long-term rates aren't actually moving all that much. I do want to point out in slide 7, though, that toward the end of the Fed's rate hike cycle, early 2006, when all of those rates started to compress together, they did have some success in pushing the long rate up about 50 or 60 basis points, simply because there was no space beneath it. In other words, there was no spread left. There was no term premiums left. So the long rate rose a little bit because it had nowhere else to go until later in 2006, when something happened, something changed, which was, you know, the housing bubble started to burst. And then the long rate said, we don't care about the Fed anymore. We're just going to go down in rates. And that's when the curve inverted. And so we see the same kind of process here in 2017 and 2018. The Fed is compressing all those rates together. And over the last few months, that has resulted in the long bond, the 10-year and the 30-year, rising a little bit in nominal yield, but not all that much, while short-term rates are pushed up much more. That has flattened the yield curve. Now, the key difference between 2004, 2006 and what we have now is, and what I tried to present here, the difference between these two slides and using the same scale for them, is that the Fed's compressing the yield curve at a much, much lower nominal level. And that is significant. And that's what really curves tell us. And it's not just the Treasury curve. We can use the Eurodollar curve and other curves. And they all tell us the same thing. We have the idea of the Fed pushing against the long-term wall, if you will, at 2.5% for the 10-year rather than 5% for the 10-year. And that is incredibly significant.
As we move on to slide number 9, I see that you're showing different segments of the curve, the front end, the middle, or the belly, as people call it, and the long end of the curve. What is this slide telling us?
Again, you're trying to get a real sense of what's going on with the yield curve. And in many ways, the yield curve is two different things. At the front end or the short end, you have monetary alternatives or money alternatives. Because as a short-term investor, whether you're an insurance company, a pension fund, a big bank, a big Japanese bank, whatever, you have alternatives for extra additional excess funds. You can invest them in something like the reverse repo, which is a Fed policy rate, or you can invest them in a short-term treasury bill. And so if the Fed's going to offer a higher rate on, say, the reverse repo or IOER, then you have less incentive to invest in a four-week treasury bill yielding a little bit less than that. Now, of course, there's obviously complications in that. But by and large, what we're looking at the shorter end of the curve is money alternatives. And that's where monetary policy has the most effect and where it hopes to have more than just a money effect. At the long end, alternatively, what we're looking at is economic alternatives. Because if you're a bank and you're holding 10-year treasury paper, your alternate is not a four-week treasury bill. You're looking at whether or not you want to make a loan, whether you want to securitize, whether you want to do any other economic things with your balance sheet. And so the long end is where all of these economic alternatives, where all these economic considerations and perceptions play out. And where they sort of start to meet is in the middle, which is why I pay attention to the 5-10 part of the yield curve rather than the 2-10, because I think that's more instructive about where the long end of economic alternatives really tells us about how the short end and the money alternatives are having any effect, or whether or not there's disagreement, disharmony there. And so it's important to look at the yield curve as really two parts that come together in the middle to tell us a lot about not just on the surface stuff with monetary policy, but the effects of it, and more than just the effects, the immediate effects, but the long-term effects. You know, what are the baseline economic considerations the market is trying to play out versus all of the short run or short duration scenarios?
So going back to the big picture, Jeff, we got into this conversation talking about how the Fed is trying to push up from the short end of the curve, trying to influence the long end of the curve and get the curve to steepen, but it doesn't seem to be happening. So how do we analyze that? How do we diagnose why it's not doing what the Fed wants it to do?
Well, I think one of the most important parts of that is, again, you know, we want to pay attention to the yield curve all the time. If you just pay attention to the yield curve when it's inverting, you're missing a whole lot. And so I think it's important to go back 10 years and retrace the steps, and even more than 10 years, and retrace all the steps that the yield curve has taken to get from there to here. Because what does it mean that when the yield curve flattens at such a low nominal level? And that's, you know, that's what the curve has been telling us for the last 10 years, what that actually means. And so if we go back to 2007, 2008, the first thing, yield curves are not supposed to be steep. You know, we talked about that before. There's an artificiality to the steep yield curve. In a normal environment, there really isn't very much steepness to it. We can get into a lot of different discussions about term premiums and things like that. But by and large, you know, the yield curve is not supposed to be steep, and it was always meant to flatten at some point. However, the point at which it is flattening is significant. In order for us to really understand that significance, we have to go back and figure out how it got here in the first place. And you know, in 2007 and 2008, amidst financial panic and crisis, the yield curve just collapsed from where it was early on in that period, you know, back in August of 2007, just before everything really started to hit. It had flattened and inverted a little bit at the front end, but it did so at still a high nominal level, around 5%. By the end of 2008, when the Fed decided it was going to do QE and ZERP in December of 2008, which is a zero interest policy, the curve had again collapsed. And what that was saying at the short end, obviously, was that the Fed was going to do a zero interest rate policy. And at the long end, the bond market was saying that, you know, this was really bad. It's going to impact economic growth and the economic growth baseline for the foreseeable future. That's what a curve at that moment in time was saying, that the Fed was going to have to do extraordinary monetary policy just to have a chance to get out of the what the long end was saying was a very bleak economic future.
And of course, what you're describing now is what we're looking at on slide number 10. As we move into slide number 11, you're showing the effects of zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing. What's going on this slide?
What I'm trying to show here is what theoretically was supposed to happen. The idea that the short end would be suppressed down to nothing via monetary policy of QE and ZERP. And what that would have done, if the market accepted that these things were going to be effective, that would have dramatically steepened the long end of the yield curve, because obviously the long end is seeing a better economic future, a better economic baseline over the long run. And so in the short term, that if it was going to work, or if the market perceived that monetary policy was going to work, that's what would have happened to the yield curve. It would first have steepened way up to really very high levels between the short and the long run, as the Fed kept the short-term rates down closer to zero, and the long-term rates kind of went up in anticipation of those things working. And so that was the curve that the Fed really wanted to see, although they were careful about not doing it too quickly, which gets into issues about forward guidance and things like that, which we can set aside for now. But in terms of the yield curve, That's what would have happened if the monetary policy was successful. The long end of the curve would have gone back up closer to and maybe even up to normal, or at least the pre-crisis levels, what we consider normal, even as short-term rates were still left very low and towards zero. That is success. And so if we get to slide number 12, what we're really looking at is that at various points in time along the last 10 years, the Treasury market at the long end was briefly and intermittently projecting success. The yield curve did steepen in these three different reflation points, which was the market, the long end especially, saying that, you know, maybe this is going to work. Maybe after QE3 and QE4 were done in 2012, that, you know, that was going to do the trick. Because remember, that was supposed to be open-ended and it was supposed to be a much different, more forceful monetary policy. And for a very brief time in late 2013, the yield curve did steepen, and that was for that period, that reflation period, the market reflecting on the fact that maybe this could work. Now, of course, as you see from the history of the curve, these were only brief periods of belief. They didn't last because after, you know, a period of just several months, in some cases, the market began to see that, you know, monetary policy wasn't working. Things weren't really changing. And therefore, the curve just went back to flattening again.
So what conclusion should we draw? We're going up to the beginning of 2018, which is when we recorded this interview. What should we conclude from the fact that it seems like we're almost back to where we were during the financial crisis in terms of how much these curves just are stubbornly not wanting to cooperate and go up the way policymakers want them to?
What's important about all that, and especially going and looking at the history of the curve over the last 10 years, and even in these reflations, which were really failed reflations, what it's telling us is that, you know, there's a great deal of uncertainty, first of all, because, you know, nobody knows with all of these experimental policies whether they actually do work. And more than that, I think there's almost a default position that people want them to work because, you know, nobody wants to be stuck in a no-growth period. And I think at these particular moments where there was an injection of optimism is the idea that, hey, you know what? This is a good thing. Maybe if monetary policy works, that gets us back to normal. That's a positive thing. We should all be happy about it. But ultimately, reality has set in, which is, you know, nothing has changed. Over the last 10 years, we've heard about recovery. We've talked about economic recovery. GDP growth is positive, but that's not the same thing as an actual recovery. What the curves are telling us in their stubbornness, really, outside of those intermittent brief reflation periods, is that the economy hasn't recovered. And furthermore, the economy does not look like it's going to. Even after 10 years in this situation, you know, the curve flattening at such a low nominal level, with the Fed pushing up the short-term rates now, is saying that nothing has changed. The Fed is making a mistake.
And does that mean, in your opinion, that the Fed should be doing something different and not raising rates right now? Or does it just mean that the Fed has made a mistake in the sense of thinking this whole thing was going to work from the beginning?
I think it's a little bit of both. And taking the second part first, I think if we go to slide 14, for example, you look at the current yield curve or a recent yield curve for the end of the year 2017, what immediately stands out is how similar it is to the yield curve from December 17th, 2008, which is the day they voted for zero interest rate policy. So in the space of 9 years, through all that happened in between, which is a whole bunch of monetary experimentation, the long end of the yield curve is practically at the same point as it was during one of the worst and darkest times in U.S. financial history. I mean, that is an astounding result. That's something that is incredibly important to understand exactly what that means and what that is telling us, that all of the things that the Fed did at the short end, all of the brief reflations aside, it didn't accomplish what it set out to accomplish. The market view of the long-term baseline economic growth in 2008 is still with us. And that is an incredibly depressing scenario, which is reflected in flattening yield curve.
Now, I want to make sure, Jeff, that I'm understanding you correctly, because it seems to me that during this period, through several rounds of quantitative easing. We have conjured, not we, the central banks of the world have conjured literally trillions of dollars of money out of thin air. And that comes at a cost. When you do quantitative easing, you're diluting the value of all of the other money that's already in circulation. So everybody paid a cost for that. You're saying that what we got for our money is basically nothing? We're back to where we started? Am I reading too much into it to say that?
Well, it's even more basic than that. Eric, if you get back to Eurodollar University, what it's saying is that quantitative easing was not creating money. And that's a very difficult concept to get. And I know it's one that we didn't cover during the Eurodollar University there, but quantitative easing, all it created was bank reserves. And bank reserves are a particular and not even a very interesting bank liability. They're a particular form of bank liability, nothing more. The Fed did not print money. And that's exactly what the yield curve is saying, by the way. We go back to Milton Friedman's interest rate fallacy. Low nominal long-term interest rates are a sign of tight, not loose money. And so the curve's obstinance at the long end reflects what I've been saying in Eurodollar University is that QE is not money printing. And that's why the Fed failed, because they thought they were printing money when the market is saying, no, you're not. You're just doing a bunch of bank reserves, which is unimportant to the problem at hand. And so the economic results of the Fed thinking it's doing one thing and the economy doing another, not recovering, is what we see in the yield curve in 2017 at the long end being equivalent to the same yield curve in 2008.
Okay, Jeff, so as I try to pull all of this together, help me understand this. Are you saying that the whole idea of doing quantitative easing, several rounds of it, was a bad idea and failed and was completely ineffective? Or are you saying the way they went about it contain mistakes, perhaps the fact that they allowed banks to receive an interest payment on depositing their excess reserves or something? Was it a question of little policy blunders along the way that prevented a good idea from being effective, or was it just a dumb idea to start with?
No, it was a dumb idea to start with. I mean, it was a 1950s solution to a 21st century banking problem. Quantitative easing has nothing to do with the actual Eurodollar system. And I think that's why the results speak for themselves in that way. First of all, if you have to do more than one quantitative easing, it doesn't work. The term itself is quantitative easing. The second part being the easing, but the first part being you know exactly what quantity to do in order to affect the easing. So if you have to do it twice, then obviously you didn't know the right quantity. And if you have to do it three or four times, then maybe it's not easing. So the whole idea of repeating quantitative easing is repeating failure, doing the same dumb thing over and over again. And what the curves are telling us is, why was that a dumb thing? Because bank reserves, which are the byproducts of quantitative easing, are money. And that's something, by the way, that the Federal Reserve will actually tell you. You go back to the literature in 2009, 2010, in the early days of quantitative easing, they know that it wasn't really money printing. And in fact, that wasn't their actual goal. Their point was more of psychology and rational expectations as well as portfolio effects. So the idea that the Fed was printing money has been conclusively shown over the last 10 years because it's been done not just here, but everywhere else around the world. It doesn't work because it's not actually printing money. And that's a very important point. And that's what's embedded in the curves and especially the long end stubbornness over the last 10 years. Even now, as the Fed's trying to raise the federal funds target corridor, and the long bond just says, you know, nothing has changed here.
As we move on in the slide deck, starting on slide 15, you're getting into deconstructing what you say here is the mainstream story of the long end and what drives it. I'm hoping you get to the real story as well as the mainstream story. Tell us more about what's going on here, starting at slide 15.
Well, I mean, we go back to Alan Greenspan's conundrum in 2005. Because he didn't really understand what's going on the long end, that kind of sparked a flurry of mainstream economic interest in what exactly is a long-term rate telling us. You know, there's a history of economists trying to break down long-term rates going back to not just Irving Fisher in the 1920s and 30s, but even before then. There's always been an idea that we can quantify everything, including breaking apart and deconstructing a long-term rate so that we can put together the pieces of it so that we can understand what is it a long-term rate telling us in its various different pieces. And what economists say are the three pieces of a long-term bond yield are expected path of short-term rates, which makes sense, the expected future inflation, which also makes sense, and something called term premiums. Term premiums are simply what a bond investor requires an additional yield to hold a longer-term bond. So like, what is the difference between yield for holding a five-year bond versus a four-year bond. If you're going to hold a five-year paper, no matter what, it doesn't have to be a treasury or whatever else, you're going to demand a little bit of extra yield for that additional time. And so that's something called a term premium. And if we go to slide 17, getting back to, you know, around 2015, 2016, what we found out, or what economists found out, was that we were essentially beginning another conundrum, because what they found was that long-term interest rates fell more outside of QE than inside of QE. In other words, the long-term rate, the 10-year yield, whatever you want to select as your long-term proxy, were lower after QE than during QE. And that really bothered them, as it should, because their whole point was to affect the treasury market through their direct action and direct policy. What they came up with, if we get to slide 18, was they say, no, the bond market was behaving. What it was doing was reducing term premiums. And so the lower long-term yields up until 2015 and 2016 was really the bond market agreeing with the Fed, just that it reduced term premiums for various reasons I won't get into here because it's kind of a tangent. And so that was their way of deconstructing the long rate so that it made sense to them, so that they could say, nah, the bond market's really doing what we think it's doing. It's just that these term premiums have collapsed. So what they expected, if we get to slide 19, was that as the Fed moved to exit its emergency policy, as they moved to raise rates on IOER in the reverse repo, that term premiums would rise in addition to the expected future inflation as well as the expected path of short-term rates. And that would have the effect of increasing nominal long bond rates. And that means that the yield curve would steepen a little as the Fed raised rates, but not by all that much. And so the whole curve would shift up back to where it was, and hopefully somewhere near 2007, 2006 level. So it would flatten out, not with the 10-year at 2.5, but it would flatten out with the 10-year like it did in 2006, maybe at 5% or something like that. And the idea of term premiums, and what economists kept saying about term premiums the last couple of years, was that it was their excuse for why the bond market was behaving what otherwise had been taken as irrationally.
So what was really going on in the bond market then?
Well, that's what we're getting to. And you know, that's why we're reviewing the history of the yield curve, because you know there's a lot of information embedded in it that's important to understanding where we are and how we got this way. And so, you know, the idea is, if you have to appeal to term premiums, which to me is a ridiculous concept to begin with, it's one of those things that economists have come up with to try to understand the bond market that they clearly don't understand. And so if you have to depend on shrinking term premiums to try to explain the way bond yields were resisting what the Fed's doing monetary policy, you don't have much of an argument or a case to begin with. And so, you know, as the Fed is now looking to raise rates, and they're doing so with the idea that term premiums are going to rise, and that's going to force long-term bond rates to go up along with short rates, that was a pretty dumb expectation to begin with. And so the bond market, the history of the yield curve, and again, not just the yield curve, but the euro dollar curve and some other things, some other indications, what they're trying to tell us is that economists once again have it all wrong. Again, go back to 2006, go back to the dot-com monetary policy cycle and what the long-term rate did during that. It didn't move because the long-term rate was saying, you know, maybe the Fed, maybe Alan Greenspan isn't a maestro. Maybe he doesn't know what he's doing. And so the long end of the curve in the last 10 years has continued that tradition at a much, much lower level, because it's telling us not only did the Fed fail in its QE, now it's seeing a recovery that just isn't there. And we can go through any number of economic statistics, whether they be inflation, the labor numbers, the participation problem, all of these economic statistics all point to the same thing, that the economy never recovered. That's the problem. That's why the long-term rate is stuck at a low nominal level. That's why the yield curve is compressing at such a low nominal level, because the Fed has failed at everything it's done, and the economy that's resulted from that isn't likely to change anytime soon.
Well, but I would say that what has changed is that the Fed's ability to be accommodative in order to accommodate the next downturn is diminished greatly. They can't, you know, dramatically reduce rates from here the way they did last time, because they're already still very low. And at the same time, I think that their ability to consider at this point more rounds of quantitative easing is going to be impaired by both political opposition and the fact it didn't really work very well last time. So it seems like if what you're saying is true, and we never really got any economic recovery of substance out of all of this effort that went into the last 9 years. When we get the next inevitable recession, it could really be a doozy, and the Fed's hands could be tied in terms of how they react to it. Am I reading too much into it to say that?
No, you got that exactly right. And that's something that the Federal Reserve actually is very much aware of and very much afraid of. If you actually read the literature, especially recently, it's been a major point of debate internally. There's various reasons for it and various explanations they've come up with to try to characterize it a little differently than you did. But I think your characterization is exactly right. They talk about things like a low R star or a natural interest rate or neutral interest rate that's maybe even zero or negative. What all that means in Fed speak and getting out of Fed speak and into regular parlance is what you just said, that they're very much aware that even though they're trying to hike rates here, they may not get very far. They're certainly not going to get back to where they were in 2006. And there's absolutely no chance they go back to where they were in the 1990s. And they know that. Now, what the debate is about is why. They're trying to figure out why can't they, you know, why is 3% perhaps the maximum of this rate hike cycle? And what does that mean? For them, it means something entirely different. They've gone on to, well, there's a drug problem in America. It's a labor force. You know, there's a low R star, which relates to that. There's no supply side growth. And they've come up with a whole range of really silly and convoluted explanations for what I think is incredibly simple. And the simple part is the yield curve. It's telling us. It's telling us not only that there is a problem, it's telling us what the problem is. And so if we look at, you know, what is the maximum level of federal funds, and it's completely different from what it has been in the past, you know, it gets back to what you just said, which was, you know, they screwed up. They screwed up in a very basic and fundamental way, which was they had no idea what was going on in the monetary system.
As we go back to this conversation that started on slide 21 with deconstructing interest rates, I'm just looking at slide 24 here. It seems like some of the things that even the Fed said they got right, your slides are telling us that they actually got wrong.
That's an important point, too, is there's a tremendous amount of denial in the Fed's position. You know, again, what Bernanke was saying in his attempt to explain low nominal long-term treasury rates was that the expected path of short-term rates as well as expected future inflation expectations were rising like the Fed thought it was supposed to, when in fact we have all sorts of evidence that the opposite took place, especially inflation expectations. From August 2014 forward, inflation expectations, market-based inflation expectations collapsed, which were saying that, you know, the Fed thinks that we're going to have an inflationary period here, and that's ultimately why they're raising interest rates to get ahead of a period of inflation when the market was saying the opposite was going to happen. There was a much higher probability in the market estimation for lower inflation moving forward than higher inflation. And five-year forward inflation rate is particularly focused on long-term expectations, the baseline setting for perceptions, or in, as the Fed would say, anchoring. And so if we use that as part of deconstructing the long-term rate, that's one part that the Fed thinks it got right of the long-term treasury rate that it didn't. The market's saying, no, inflation expectations are lower, not higher. You get back to the yield curve in slide 25, you know, the shape of the yield curve along with the inflation expectations. And you can see after 2013, it's right there. Inflation expectations go along very much with the flattening of the yield curve at low nominal rates. So no, the Fed in deconstructing the long-term rate on that part of the equation or that part of the segment of long-term rates, they didn't get that right. There was no reason to expect that the market was expecting higher inflation because the market is saying, no, we don't expect higher inflation. The TIPS market is pretty much in universal agreement that compared to not just recently, but also the pre-crisis period, there is much more of a downside to inflation risk than any kind of upside. So that basis for the Fed expecting higher nominal long rates, as well as their entire thesis of increasing short-term rate as they have been, is undercut directly here.
So we're talking about expected path of long-term rates. What about expected path of short-term rates?
It's the same thing as inflation. You know, the Fed thinks that it got that right, right? Those are the two parts the Fed believes it got right. Expected inflation was going to rise, and that was going to help increase the bond rate, as well as the expected path of short-term rates, which is, you know, the Fed would believe that because they believe they control short-term rates. If you look on slide 26, for example, if you look at Eurodollar futures, that's what it's been telling us over the last 10 years, too, that the market is expecting lower short-term interest rates, not higher short-term interest rates. We're not talking about relative to last year. You know, the market doesn't care what the federal funds was doing last year. It's in relation to the entire period. Where are interest rates, short-term interest rates, where are money alternative rates going to ultimately land when everything shakes out with this cycle? What the market is saying is that the expected path of short-term rates isn't hugely stunted. You know, like we just talked about before, the Fed doesn't even believe it's going to get all that high, and the market agrees. So if we're deconstructing a long-term bond yield, the two bottom portions, as I showed them before, the Fed thinks it got right. The market is saying it didn't. The market is saying it got wrong. Inflation expectations are low, as well as the market in Eurodollar futures, not just Eurodollar futures either, is saying that the Fed is never going to get very high at all. No matter how many rate hikes it thinks it's going to do, it may not ever get to that many. And so if we go to slide 27, that's reflected in the Eurodollar futures curve in various points along the way. And what we see is it collapsing like the Treasury curve. It's flattening out at a very low rate. And that is, again, a negative reflection on both monetary policy and the products of monetary policy, which are a lack of recovery and the foreseeable future where that lack of recovery remains the baseline case.
Jeff, as I hear you talking, I keep being reminded of a view that we've heard from several different guests on the Macro Voices podcast, particularly Dr. Lacey Hunt, who has opined that, look, we're just stuck for the foreseeable future, and I think he's talking decades, in a low-yield environment for the simple reason that there has been this explosive growth of debt. We've doubled the Treasury debt from the financial crisis until now, and private debt around the world is increasing too. There's so much debt. The argument that Dr. Hunt makes is just with that amount of debt, it could never be serviced at higher rates. We're stuck, you know, we're turning Japanese essentially. We're stuck with very low yields for a very long time to come. Is there merit to that view? Is it correct? Does it jibe with what you see in the work that you do? And if not, why not?
I think it does in a way. I don't think it's a primary consideration of what's driving yields, but I think it's absolutely a serious enough and substantial consideration in what's keeping rates low. Again, we go back to our conversation earlier where the Treasury market reflects risk. And, you know, he's absolutely right. There is absolutely so much debt, not just here, but all around the world, China, for example. There is so much debt that it is an inordinate risk that we have to pay attention to. As much as unpleasant as it is, and as much as we may want to have, you know, economic growth just inflate everything away, there's a tremendous risk that that never happens. And so we do kind of get into a situation very much like Japan's, where it's not unreasonable to expect that low-term rates are now structural. Again, you wouldn't call the Japanese government bond market a bull market for that reason, because it was a structural problem that has never been solved. They've never been able to create economic growth, and they've been left with the overhang of debt, which depresses everything. It really does. And so we're in a similar situation, I think, for a lot of the same reasons, where we should look at structurally low nominal interest rates. And I believe that's also what the Fed is actually thinking, too. They don't want to admit it, and they don't want to admit the reasons for it. Again, they're trying to come at it from a very different angle, a very convoluted angle, in order to arrive at a conclusion where everybody agrees that interest rates, if they go higher, they're not going a hell of a lot much higher, and what that means for everything.
So as I look back to your slide deck, Jeff, I see that you're deconstructing interest rates in beginning at slide 28. Does that relate to what we just talked about? And maybe you can walk us through this.
Yeah, and I think that gets back to the idea of structurally low interest rates or structurally low nominal rates, especially at the long end, and how that will play out in the short end. And that's why ultimately the curve is flattening where it is rather than where it should be. And so if we go back into our different parts of the long-term bond yield, you know, we just went through the expected path of short-term rates structurally is a lot lower, not higher. The expected future inflation, lower, not higher. Term premiums, I think that, you know, what Dr. Lacey Hunt talked about, what you just talked about, Eric, with risk in terms of massive amount of debt and the overhang of it and what that does to depress economic growth and the lack of monetary growth that goes along with everything here, you know, including Eurodollar University. What that all works out to in terms of term premiums, expected path of future rates, expected path of short, is that we should expect Japanification, especially in the government bond market. Long-term interest rates are not going to rise all that much, if they rise at all. In fact, I'm not convinced that we haven't seen the low in long-term rates yet. I don't think we've seen the low in the U.S. 10-year. I don't think we've seen the low in the 30-year. I think that we're actually moving between dollar events where the next one is going to take everything even lower. So when we look at what the yield curve is telling us, especially from the example of 2000 to 2006, and use that as a template for our expectations in the current curve, what it tells us is a great deal of information far above whether or not the yield curve is going to invert, whether that means recession. There's a whole lot of stuff there that we need to pay attention to that impacts a lot more than just, you know, whether where we are in a business cycle.
Jeff, help me understand what in my mind is kind of a paradox when I hear Dr. Lacey Hunt talk about, okay, look, problem is way too much debt, just excessive, therefore got to have low interest rates because you couldn't service it otherwise. Well, on the face of it, that logic seems to make sense. But when I step back and think about it, I think, wait a minute. Normally, when you have concern about the ability of a borrower to repay, to meet the, you know, Greece is defaulting, everybody's concerned that they're not going to be able to pay their debt back. Normally, when you're concerned that somebody cannot pay their debt back, yields go through the roof to the upside because in order for anyone to want to buy that paper, they have to be compensated for the risk they're taking of default. So help me understand, if you've got what everybody seems to agree is just a ridiculously large amount of debt, meaning that it could be argued that it's impossible to repay it in real terms. Of course, you could inflate it away, but in terms of real purchasing power, it may be impossible to repay the amount of debt that exists in the system. If we need to be worried about the ability of borrowers to repay their debt, why wouldn't that be causing yields to go in the other direction to reflect risk premium?
I think you're right, and I don't think it's really a paradox at all. If the market was concerned about the payment, which is really credit risk, interest rates would be skyrocketing. And we've seen countless examples of that even recently. And so I think that points us in the opposite direction. And again, if we go to slide 30, what we're really talking about is the interest rate fallacy. What Milton Friedman said was the interest rate fallacy is that low long-term interest rates are a sign of tight money. What tight money means, in other words, tight money in the real economy means that there's a great amount of economic risk as well as liquidity risk. And those two perceptions overwhelm any kind of credit risk. So in other words, you could be concerned about the Bank of Japan and the government of Japan's ability to pay back Japanese debt. However, if the economy is atrocious and the monetary system is tight, then liquidity risk overwhelm credit risk. And so you're going to hold Japanese government debt because it's the most liquid interest instrument, even though it embeds a whole lot of credit risk. That's why interest rates stay low, is because there are other risk considerations that have become paramount over and above credit risk. And I think you have a similar situation in the United States, where especially U.S. Treasuries as the sole, I don't want to say sole, but the primary safe asset in the entire Eurodollar system, there is a tremendous amount of liquidity premium, if you want to call it that, embedded in long-term interest rates. As long as money in the Eurodollar system remains tight and as long as the Eurodollar system remains relevant, then there is liquidity risk that is reflected in structurally lower nominal long-term yields. And again, economic risk as well. Because if you're a bank like, you know, JP Morgan and its fortress portfolio, are you going to lend to reignite another housing bubble, or is it just easier to hold the 10-year paper? Especially with its funding capabilities in the repo market, rehypothecation. And so I don't think there's any mystery to lower long-term interest rates, especially when, you know, again, Milton Friedman's interest rate fallacy has been proven throughout history. What he said was the fallacy is that everybody believes that when interest rates are low, that is stimulus. And so that's a good thing. That's because of what we talked about with the Federal Reserve, the myth of the Federal Reserve, and everybody believing the Federal Reserve has total control over these spaces. And the interest rate fallacy says, no, lower long-term interest rates, as had happened in the United States during the Great Depression, tells us that money is tight in the system, in the real economy. And that's where we see low long-term interest rates, when money is tight. And conversely, long rates were rising and rapidly when? In the 1970s, during the Great Inflation, when money was plentiful and, in fact, abundant and too abundant. It's the opposite of what we end up thinking. Interest rates tell us a lot more about what's going on, and more than that, why it's going on. And so if we deconstruct interest rates, especially at the long end, and their obstinance against what the Fed is trying to do with short-term rates, it's telling us not just what's wrong, but why. The money is tight, which is an enormous drag on the global economy, which creates all of these risks that get reflected back into lower long-term interest rates on a structural basis.
Moving on to slide 31, you're showing baseline growth and a divergence in U.S. real GDP that's pretty significant. What's going on this slide? What's this telling us?
It's the economic consequences of monetary breakdown. That's what the long-term interest rate and the yield curve collapse is telling us, that no matter what the Fed does, and again, as we talked about before, quantitative easing only created bank reserves. I mean, it's pretty clear to me, and I think it should be pretty clear to everybody, there's no correlation there. What the Fed did and what the economy did, two separate things. And so the Fed created a bunch of bank reserves that had no bearing on the monetary situation globally. And the consequence of that is the U.S. economy shrunk. And it isn't just the U.S. economy. If we go to slide 32, the European economy. And it's not just the U.S. and Europe. We can see the same pattern repeated all over the world, where the economic system, whatever the pre-crisis baseline growth was, has been completely obliterated. We don't grow at nearly the same way we used to. And that's not something that just happens randomly. It's not something that you can expect to happen in everywhere either. What is the only way that we can tie all of these things together? These low structural interest rates, these low levels of economic growth, the radical departures in economic growth, the fact that the global economy hasn't recovered. What is the only thing that's common to all of these elements? We get back to the interest rate fallacy, which is tight money, which is the Eurodollar system.
Jeff, you've got several more slides in the presentation here, starting at number 32, which I think are basically evidence to support what you've just already told us. Please walk us through the slides in terms of what each one of them is telling us about the picture that you just painted for us.
Going by the comparison of the yield curve and the flattening where it is, if the interest rate fallacy is a valid theory, then we should be able to observe it somewhere other than the yield curve or the Eurodollar curve, correct? I mean, if it's that bad and if it's a global problem, we should be able to easily find evidence for it. And that is, in fact, the case. And we can find it in all sorts of different ways, whether it be the tick data on cross-border U.S. dollar financing, which you can see on slide 33, if it massive growth up until Bear Stearns. And so between 2002 and 2008, rapid growth, which affords with our sense of what was going on in that period. High risk, but rapid monetary growth. Since Bear Stearns, or since 2008, almost no growth. And not just no growth, but much more volatile growth, or much more volatile pattern of behavior, where each of these reflation points that we talked about before in the yield curve are reflected in monetary conditions. Ultimately, what we would take away from this chart and from the others, if you go to slide 34, is that we had a system, a Eurodollar system, that up until 2007, 2008, was growing and growing rapidly, which, again, that matches up with our sense of what was happening during those periods. Since then, no matter what the Fed has done with quantitative easing or what the European Central Bank has come up with all of its various programs, or the Bank of Japan or anybody else around the world, no matter what the central banks do, since 2007, 2008, there has been largely and in general no monetary growth, tight money. We can even look at it on slide 35 in terms of derivatives. Derivative growth is a very central component of the Eurodollar system, as we talked about in Eurodollar University. It's one of the ways and one of the primary ways that banks transform their balance sheet to, as you put it on several occasions, Eric, to create credit and money out of thin air. They did that through the ability to trade derivatives. And again, what we find out is, you know, up until 2007, 2008, rapid growth. Since 2007, 2008, we have not just lack of growth, but actual shrinking. Banks are shrinking their derivative books for various reasons, among them, the lack of recovery in the economy. And so, you know, no matter where we look, the rest of the slides are various incarnations, various indications of tight money. We can look at all of these different places, and they all tell us the same thing with the yield curve. That is, the monetary system broke on August 9th, 2007. The Eurodollar system broke, and it has never been repaired. And the economic consequences of that are what we saw in the slides earlier with the global economy never recovering. And so what we've put together here is a comprehensive picture, not just of the yield curve, but corroborating what the yield curve is telling us in the sense that Milton Friedman had it, which is the interest rate fallacy, which is tight money and the effects of tight money. And in many ways, it's really just a textbook case of it. The difference is, and why the economists and why policymakers and central banks can't get it, is because their definition of money isn't euro dollars, isn't balance sheet capacity. It's not the euro dollar system. They're looking at the wrong thing. And they're making all sorts of mistakes because they're looking at the wrong thing, starting with what happened in 2008 to begin with.
Jeff, you've made several references to they're looking at the wrong thing, and because they're looking at the wrong thing, they've done the wrong thing. And the policy actions you think that have occurred since 2009 have been ineffective. Is there something they should have done? If you were in charge, what would you have done differently in order to effect more effective monetary policy?
Well, I think what they should have done was reset everything in 2008. That was the perfect opportunity to do it. The best time, I use that word reluctantly, it's not really the best, but the best time to do some kind of structural change like that is when everything is bad, because there's consensus, not just consensus, there's urgency behind the consensus to do the hard things. And what the hard thing would have been to look at the Eurodollar system and say that the thing just doesn't work. And I mean that not just in the practical sense that it broke on August 9, 2007, but it never really worked before that, because it was essentially a rapid, unchallenged monetary growth that affected the entire global economy in a way that, even today, we still don't really understand all the ramifications of it. And so it was never an inherently stable system to begin with. And I think that really is what they should have done in 2008. Was said, okay, realize, first of all, that we have a euro-dollar system, not a dollar system. And number two, we need to replace the euro-dollar system with something that's actually stable as best as possible, something that could be sustainably stable, not just stable for a couple of years at a time, but a system that was robust enough that it could withstand the rigors of the modern global economy. That was the best part of the euro-dollar system, or at least what made it grow as fast and as far as it did, was that it was incredibly adaptable to technological change from the 1960s to the 21st century. It evolved pretty much in lockstep with the economy. And so it was not an easy task in 2008 to say, okay, what can we replace the Eurodollar system with? But that was the time to do it, to at least be able to say that we need to do something, because this is a big problem here. If we don't fix the monetary system, we're not going to get a recovery. I don't know if anybody would have been brave enough to say that, but that's really what would have happened, is that the realization that if we don't get this right, we're screwed. We're screwed in the long run. So that's what they should have done, is look at a complete monetary realignment, which is not as drastic and as dangerous as it sounds, because we've had them throughout our history before. It would have taken enough political will and urgency to do it. And that's why I think that was the time to have done it.
Moving forward from here, what are the lessons of all this? What should investors be interpreting from the yield curve? How should they be using it? And what signals should they be looking for from the yield curve as we go forward from this point?
Well, I think the main idea, or the major general impression, is slide 39 here. If you look at where the yield curve is now, or where it was recently, compared to where it should be, if everything was going to be as is described in the media and such, if we're actually heading to a period of higher inflation and better economic growth, then the yield curve would be flattening where the green line is in 2007 rather than where it is now. And so the yield curve flattening here at a low nominal rate tells us that chances of all of that happening are very, very low, at least in the market estimation. I mean, you can decide that the market's wrong if you wish, but the treasury market is as deep and as large and as liquid as there is in the world. And so if we're going to pay attention to one market, I think that would be it. And again, the point of the presentation here is that it's corroborated by a whole bunch of other things. What that's telling us is that the economy hasn't much changed since 2008, because the curve hasn't much changed since 2008. The Fed is raising rates based on a lot of the wrong ideas about both the economy and the monetary system. And that therefore the downside risks to whatever your investment choice might be are serious, substantial, and sustained. They're persistent. They don't go away, because nothing really has changed over that period.
There's a viewpoint that a lot of people expressed shortly after quantitative easing was implemented. They said this is the wrong thing, and among other things, it's going to set us up where we're going to end up in a trap situation where when the next crisis hits, it's going to be guaranteed to be much worse than the 2008 crisis because we will have gotten ourselves to this point where there's no room to accommodate and we're really in a pickle. And it's that next crisis that's going to be the real killer. Now, that was back in 2009, 2010, that was a very commonly held view. It seems like these days a lot of people have kind of forgotten that view. It feels like, hey, maybe this thing actually worked and there is no ill effect after all. Is that a false sense of security? Are we still looking at a situation where the next crisis is going to necessarily be worse than the last because of what has maybe been a failed set of remedies to the last crisis? And if so, what do investors look for in terms of signals from the yield curve or elsewhere in order to tell them when that next crisis is upon us?
Well, I think what you're saying is really two different things here. And one relates to monetary policy and one relates to the real economy and everything else outside of it. As far as monetary policy, you're right. And I think that's the part that the Fed's going to have to come up with. They're going to have to try to explain how do they deal with the next crisis starting from such a weakened position to begin with. And I mean that not just in terms of monetary policy, because they're not going to get interest rates, the short-term rate, very high to begin with, so they'll have less room to reduce it. Not that it, in my opinion, that doesn't make much difference to begin with, but in their minds, it certainly does, because that raises the possibility that they're going to have to do some other experimental policies to, in their mind, make up for what they might call a lack of altitude in the federal funds rate. So there's risk there. I mean, what is the next step for the Fed? It can't just be quantitative easing. It's got to be something like super quantitative easing or a different form of quantitative easing. Or if you really want to get weird, they can get into negative interest rates or even something like a negative imposition on cash, which has been raised before by several prominent economists. So it raises the probability the Fed doing something even more stupid than what it has done in the past, because they're going to feel the pressure to do something even bigger, given all of those past failures. Now, the other part of it is, I think what you said is pretty relevant to today, is that we go through these periods, or at least over the last 10 years, these reflation periods where when the yield curve is steepening, as it had in, say, late 2013, people get this false sense of confidence that, hey, things are working, the system may be actually recovering. There may actually be something going on here. And that is, I think it's important to realize that what followed from that is, you know, you go back to 2014, we heard then all of the same things that we hear now. You know, economists were adamant in 2014 that inflation was about to hit in 2015. Of course, it did the opposite. They were adamant in 2014 that economic growth was going to pick up in a big way. And remember, in the middle two quarters of 2014, GDP was plus 4% and plus 5%. And they were talking like that was going to be the baseline case moving forward. And at the same time, the yield curve was flattening if nominal rates were falling, which was telling them that they were making a big mistake. And so I think that's instructive to setting our expectations in 2017, 2018, is that the yield curve is saying, okay, maybe there's a possibility things get better here, that inflation's going to pick up, but not really. It's not really a good chance that this stuff happens. And, you know, that gets back to slide 39. The yield curve flattening at a low nominal level. What ultimately that nominal level is, you know, we don't really know. But there really isn't any difference with the 10-year at, say, 2.5% or 3%. It's not 5 or 6%. And so as long as the nominal rate and the flattening takes place at a low nominal level, the yield curve is telling us, in corroboration with all of this other stuff, that we really shouldn't expect that things are going to change in a meaningful fashion.
Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic set of insights into the yield curve and the whole situation that we find ourselves in as we look forward into the end of this decade. Before we close, though, please tell us a little bit more about what you do at Alhambra Investments. What business are you guys in, and where can people who are interested in following your work learn more about what you do there?
Yeah, Alhambra Investments is a registered investment advisor based out of Florida. We manage portfolios for the retail investor, anybody with, you know, $50,000 up until $10 million. We have clients that run the gamut, whether it be retirement funds or just personal funds, whatever they have investable. My role at Alhambra is trying to set the baseline for understanding how we should invest in getting a real and honest sense of where we are so that we can invest intelligently, understanding the risks of investing in this kind of situation. Because frankly, this is the most challenging investment environment, I think, probably since the 1930s. It might be overstating it a little bit, but probably not as much as maybe many people might think. So our goal at Alhambra is to try to bring understanding of risk so that we can be better investors with that in mind.
Well, Jeff, I cannot thank you enough for another fantastic interview. We're going to have to leave it there. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Jeff. You know, what resonated with me was halfway through the interview, he mentions that QE was not creating money. It only created bank reserves. And that really resonated with me because I fall into that camp of secular disinflation and these inflationary cyclical surges that come into the market, that kind of Lacey Hunt view of the world. And when I hear that, it kind of, to me, is the supporting evidence that of my kind of perspectives on all of this. The way I kind of look at it is that QE isn't inflationary until it creates credit through the banking system. And right now it sits as reserves on these banks. Nonetheless, it was interesting presentation all around. What did you take away from it?
Well, that's an excellent point. You know, my view on the inflation topic is I just think it's so important. And frankly, I'm not smart enough to know what is going to eventually bring on significant inflation, not just, you know, the Fed getting to their next target. But when we start to get to a problem where it becomes difficult to control inflation, I think that's where we really start to see the fireworks go off. Because let's face it, in a deflationary backdrop, no matter what goes wrong, the Fed can just conjure more money out of thin air in order to solve the problem. If you've got a problem, which is inflation, suddenly just making more money exacerbates the problem rather than solving it. Suddenly their hands are tied. Their favorite tool of making more money is no longer available to them, and anything can happen. So I don't know when it's coming, Patrick, but if you want to know what keeps me up at night, it's someday inflation's going to be back in a big way, and it's not going to be pretty. Anyway, we've got a fantastic post-game chart book of considerable proportion to add to a very excellent and slightly overtime interview with Jeff Snyder today. So let's dive right into it. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. It says Postgame Chartbook. The title of the presentation is A Tour Around Global Equity Markets. Patrick, take it away. What's in the chartbook?
Well, you know what? We've been really seeing in the last couple of weeks this big surge in the NASDAQ and everyone thinking, you know, asking whether it's all over. But I think that there's a lot to be said about looking around the world, how all the global equity markets have behaved to put into context what's happening in the U.S. And what I did was I put together a chart book to kind of take us around a number of the global big global indices to sort of see what happened over the last little while on each one of them. Now, when we talked about doing this in the post game, it was prior to the Fed announcement and the recent drop we had today at Thursday's close. We had the big S&P drop to the downside. We're somewhere around 2643 right now on the S&P. But really, in the prior days to the Fed, there was this big debate amongst those that will remain bearish, thinking that the market was going to stay in this correction, and others who believe that it's all over, it's all cooled, and it's gone. And so I highlighted two comments from two popular narratives. The first one coming from Mark Cudmore, which we had on the show at the start of the year. And it was just quoting him. It was out in the media. It was saying that he turned bearish on global stocks back on January 31st and has since repeatedly said that equities won't find a solid base to bounce from until yields cool, investors deleverage, and the bears Powell openly, and he says there are signs of the last requirement, but the deleveraging seen has been insufficient relative to the level of U.S. yields. And so you have the Mark Cudmore camp, and you know, there's numerous, like the variant perception team and others, including ourselves, who've been looking for this correction to play out. Usually it can last even 8 to 12 weeks. It goes, you know, 10, 15, sometimes 20% in its corrections, and then it reverses. But there's a second narrative that was very popular, and that's on page 3, where it was, and to highlight, I have Marko Kolonovic from JP Morgan, who had the view that this mirrored a lot of the 2015 market correction. And it, in his mind, he's thought that all of the stuff that had to happen already did. The shock has played through the system. 1 month momentum was going to roll up, and suggested that the market now should be heading towards all-time highs again relatively soon. Obviously, with today's drop, we can have a little bit of a bias as to which one is more right than another. But, you know, there's been a struggle in the last two, 3 weeks with this very
argument. Let me just chime in there, Patrick, and ask you for a view on something. Because as I listen to you talk, to me, I just see these dominoes lining up in my head. It seems to me like what's going on is evidenced by today's action. And we're looking at 26.43 spot 50 as we're taping just after the close on Thursday. It seems to me like the move down to retest the lows is definitely happening. So as far as whether or not there's going to be a move to new highs or a move to retest the lows, we're getting some kind of retest. How far it goes remains to be seen. Now, does that mean that the world's coming to an end and the market crashes from here? It seems to me like the perfect setup is we go down and we retest the lows. Then you get that short squeeze in the bond market that takes bond yields lower, and everybody breathes a sigh of relief, and equities are no longer being slammed by these high bond yields. And what happens is we get a rally off of that low. We go not only a full retrace, but up to new all-time highs. Hallelujah, everything's better. And then guess what? The short squeeze is over. Jeff Gundlach is still right, and we move back into that secular trend north of 3% on Treasury yields. And this time, it's a big problem, and it's not just a correction, but it's the beginning of a bear market. What do you think in terms of the way I'm lining up the dominoes?
I think you're right, but I think you want to add one more variable, because I'm going to present it as a what if. But what if actually the short squeeze starts with the dollar? What if the fact that we are seeing these LIBOR OIS spreads blowing out and all these things are setting up for a dollar squeeze? And what if the dollar squeeze is what precedes the bonds having their squeeze? And then you have the making for what would be definitely an equity rebound.
And that would set everything up from a timing standpoint to just about what you would normally expect in terms of seasonality, which is we get some kind of summer rally. We get, you know, June, July-ish. We get a new high as these short squeezes are playing out, and it all feels great in August, and then it starts to get really scary around September or so as Jeff Gundlach's view of greater than 3% on the 10-year starts to come to fruition. You know, we're putting a lot of dominoes here, so don't anybody think this is a prediction or forecast. But if I had to pick a favorite narrative of how a perfect storm could come together from all the different themes that we've heard from a lot of different guests, that sounds like it to me.
Well, you know what? I'm in the camp of thinking that a large chunk of this year is an extended topping formation. And during that time, it's very messy, big rallies, active distribution into the rallies, chops back and forth. It looks really messy. And I don't think the bear market really kicks in until they sniff the recession. And, you know, the markets always front run the potential recession. But I don't think that this is all unraveling here going into March and April. I think that this is something that plays out much in the second half of the year.
I couldn't agree more. Let's continue, though, and look at the rest of your chart book here. What are you seeing in other markets around the world?
Starting in page 4, which is the title page, we just wanted to start off by looking at the Asian markets, and I thought this was really interesting. I started on chart 5 with the Bombay, the BSE in India, and really what you can see, what I did actually on all of the charts is I took the market correction that started in January and took the February low, and I put a 50% retracement line. Why 50%? I didn't want to look at it just like a Fibonacci retracement perspective, but I wanted to give us a line from which we can measured the magnitude of each bounce to kind of compare how each market behaved after the February drop. And what we can see here in the Bombay market was that after the drop in February, it just traded sideways and then continued making lower lows, just continuously selling. We have not seen any attempts to recover in Bombay. And then you can go and look at the next chart on page 6 is the China A50. Similar chart. You had a retracement off of that February drop, just surpassed the 50% retracement temporarily, but already we're rolled over like it's ready to sell. And so it was a relatively weak bounce. I mean, and it more or less is already actively distributing. So on chart 7, I have the Nikkei. We'll just quickly show it. Once again, after that February sell-off, the Nikkei bounced up to about the 22,500 area and barely a 50% retracement and has been consolidating near its February lows for the last 6 weeks. So you have a scenario where all of these markets continue to be incredibly weak in Asia. And the last chart I have here is the emerging market index. I mean, it's not all Asian countries in there, but I just thought I'd put it in this bundle. And the bottom line here as well, it looks like a very weak S&P 500 chart, kind of bounced after the February lows and is now already rolling over.
So to summarize, we're seeing lots of different chart patterns, but they really all have something in common, which is things changed at the end of January. There was a major correction and there's some kind of bounce that's going on in these various different markets. Exactly what it looks like is different in each case. How does Europe stack up in comparison?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I just want to make one point. The one thing that we are seeing is that all of these global equity markets look completely different than the American markets. What we're seeing is that they all look like they're in the middle of a correction and that there's another leg coming. It's only and we'll see when we get to the American markets, it's only the American markets that have different looking charts. So when we go to Europe here, what I did on going through charts 10 through 15 is we have the Euro Stock 50. And what's really interesting in these charts when we go through Europe is that the rally has been nothing short of completely pathetic on a relative basis. So the Euro Stock 50 didn't even muster up a 50% retracement after February low, has now twice retested that February low and looks ready to go to another leg lower. And you can get that same sense when going to all the individual European indices, starting with on page 11, the London FTSE, which is now making lower lows. Just dead cap bounces every time and it's been just actively distributing. The German DAX couldn't even muster up a half decent rally after that February sell-off. On page 13, the French CAC index, which mustered up a retracement, but still incredibly weak. And what I can take away from that, and one thing that I'll point out, there is definitely a currency variable. There is a natural tendency that the countries with the strongest currencies tend to have a headwind for their equity markets, and the countries with the weakest currencies tend to have a tailwind. And so it's very natural in the way that the US dollar has been behaving that these European markets should actually be underperforming. And that would be an interesting observation, by the way, if we saw that if we did eventually get a US dollar short squeeze, whether or not that would usher in a period from which the European equity markets would recover faster than the US markets.
You know, something I noticed that's really interesting to me, Patrick, is I look through your various different European indices. You've got the 20-day moving average superimposed on top of all of these charts. And if I look at these different markets all around Europe, what they were doing relative to their 20-day before January, it's all over the map. It depends on where you're looking and what it's doing. Yet, it's a very consistent pattern from the January dip on. All of them appear to be basically capped by their 20-day moving average, or a couple of them that just barely moved above it. They didn't last more than a day or so, and they ended up moving below it. So it seems like there's really been a convergence in terms of the pattern all across Europe, and that everything is now being limited by its 20-day.
Absolutely. And so in the final part of the chart book, we moved on to North America. I started off with just a very quick look at the Mexican BMV. And what you can see here is that the Mexican market, actually what's interesting is the Mexican market started selling in December. It didn't start in January. So the sell-off has actually been longer and deeper on a relative scale, but it's been very, very weak. It has not been able to muster up. Obviously, with the NAFTA and other types of headwinds, it's certainly something that is keeping it a little little bit of pressure on this market. Next, I have the Canadian TSX 60, which did muster up about a 50% retrace. But what's amazing is how deep the sell-off was in the first place. In February, the Canadian TSX 60 wiped out the entire September to January rally in just like 9 days. It was just a bloodbath. So a dead cat bounce that musters up a 50% retrace from such an oversold state was quite normal, but very, very bearish looking Canadian TSX 60. And the only place where we find healthier looking markets is when we go to the US. But what's interesting is when we go, our first chart on page 17 I have is the Dow Jones. And what's interesting is the Dow Jones Industrial Average has been by far the weakest U.S. indice, a broader indice anyway. And it seems they have failed rally attempts, so active distribution. And that has obviously influenced that S&P chart on page 18, which we're now seeing that breakdown. It's actually 40 points lower than where we took this snapshot on the S&P. But what's interesting is that all of this short-term strength we have seen in the S&P and Dow, where did it come from? And that's really the interesting part, is that where the strength we've seen and what's given all of the bulls the kind of confidence to keep trying to stay with the bull side is on charts 19 and 20, on pages 19 and 20, where we looked at the Russell, and the Russell 2000 small caps, even though it's not weighted in the large cap indices, is still trading near its 2018 highs. And when we move on to the NASDAQ during that last rally actually managed to muster up even higher highs. And so what we had was a huge tech and small cap rally that has been able to give the U.S. equity market some solid tailwind to push them higher. But there is no global indice that is giving the bull narrative any support.
You know, it's interesting. As I look at these charts, Patrick, if I look at your Russell, I look at your NASDAQ, which have both moved higher now. You know, these charts, they definitely look pretty healthy. And as you say, some of the other international charts, they look pretty darn scary. But if I go back and I look at both the Canadian TSX and the Mexican BMV, now these charts appear to be a lot more bearish just in terms of where the current price level is. But I also notice they're just full of gaps. And, you know, trading lore says that gaps always get filled. So that almost suggests that these other indices, the Mexican and Canadian indices, need to move up following the U.S. indices in order to fill those gaps. That would be consistent with the scenario that we talked about earlier of moving back to a higher high before everything really falls apart later in the year.
Absolutely. I think our narrative that we've been sharing on the show for the last 6 weeks is pretty much still my favorite scenario. I still think that this isn't the big one. I still think that this correction, while it may still go substantially lower here on the very interim, is likely to offer a buy on dip into the summer. But we are no longer in the bull market phase. I think this is now transitioning to an extended topping formation that gets very, very messy in the stock market. And I think that all of our listeners should strap on the seatbelts, because I think it's going to be a lot of whipsaw in the market.
I couldn't agree more. And of course, we should always throw out the caveat that this is not a forecast. Anything can happen here. Market could crash tomorrow. Remember 87. So don't blame us if this tentative outlook doesn't play out. But I certainly agree with you, Patrick. I think the most likely scenario here is we go down, we retest the lows, we end up recovering probably on the heels of a short squeeze in the U.S. dollar and or the treasury bond market, that gets us up to new all-time highs in stocks, and it all comes falling apart, probably led by treasury yields moving higher in the summer sometime. Meanwhile, we do need to leave it there. Thanks, everyone, for sticking around for a long show. Of course, we need your help promoting the show, because, of course, the more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. If you haven't already, please go to macrovoices.com, register your free account. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest stuff we could find each week, including things like the handouts for our feature interviews, but also the best research that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, you'll find the transcript for today's interview, which I think a lot of our listeners will want to re-review with the chart book. And so the link for the chart book for Jeffrey Snyder's presentation and the chart book we discussed in this post game with all the equity charts, the links are also in that email as well on the website. There's also a fun article written by Kevin Muir on rethinking European stocks and an interesting article from Convexity maven Harley Bassman titled How Will I Know? You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend or myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.